Welcome, everybody. This is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach, and this is the Right Now Mastermind class for April 2013. I'm so happy to welcome our guest today. Joanne Early Mackin is the author of Write a Poem Step by Step. Her newest picture books are Baby Says Moo, Waiting Out the Storm, and Flip, Float, Fly, Seeds on the Move. Her poems appear in a number of magazines and anthologies, and she has also written more than 125 nonfiction books for young readers. Joanne earned her MFA in writing for children and young adults at Vermont College of Fine Arts. She teaches at Mount Mary College, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Continuing Education, and UW-Madison's Summer Write by the Lake program. And she speaks about poetry and writing to children and adults at schools, libraries, and conferences. Visit her website at joannemackin.com. Welcome, Joanne. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Great. And I want to, before we launch into our conversation, I want to remind everybody that Joanne's giving away a copy of her book at my blog, rightnowcoach.com/blog. So go ahead and enter. You have until tonight at midnight to do that. After the call is over, I'm going to send you a copy of the recording with a link to Joanne and her book so that you'll have that. So Joanne, why don't you just start by telling us how you got started writing for children? How did this career path come about?
Well, in a sort of a long roundabout way, when I was in college many years ago, I took a creative writing class, and I wrote a very short poem, 8 lines, about my sister Judy and her cats that always slept on her bed. I lived with Judy in an apartment at the time near the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and I had a dog and she had 2 cats, and the cats slept on her bed and the dog slept on mine. And so I wrote a little poem in this class and put it away and completely forgot about it. And then about 20 years later, I was married, and my husband and I had 2 sons, young at the time. And one day I was reading to them, I was reading a picture book, and I just thought, gee, wouldn't it be fun to write a children's book someday? And I remembered that poem that I had written in college, and I went to the file cabinet and found it, thinking that maybe I could revise it and turn it into a picture book. Well, lo and behold, when I found the poem, there was a note on it from my instructor that said, this might make a good children's book.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a jolt. Anyway, I revised that manuscript, and I sent it out many, many times. And after the first few times, I realized that it needed a lot of work. First of all, it was way too short because picture books are typically 32 pages long. And with only 8 lines, that's not long enough for a picture book. So after one editor kindly told me that I needed to get to extend the length, I added a lot more to it, mainly by reworking some of the lines and turning them around so that there was a reverse sort of a form of each line. And that helped to extend it, and then just adding more to the story. And so that book, when it was finally accepted, was called Cats on Judy. The publisher told me that she was actually looking for a cat book at that time. So timing was really important.
Wow.
There was a lot of luck to it, but she was actually looking for something about cats because one of her best-selling books had a cat on the cover, even though it wasn't actually about cats. So she said she thought that a lot of people picked that book up because of the cat, so she wanted to publish a cat book. So that was lucky.
Wow.
And that's what got me started. That was my first book. 1997, that book was published, Cats on Judy.
Oh, that's amazing. And and what kinds of things do you most enjoy writing and why? I notice that you've done both fiction picture books and nonfiction books, so and poetry. What's your kind of passion in there?
Well, I'm a word person. I really love language, and I really like playing around with words. Sometimes, unfortunately, even more than plots, so I have to keep a rein on that. But I really like poetry and picture books and short things like that, because ever since our kids were little, when I first started writing, I found that I could keep something brief in my head mm-hmm. better than I could remember a whole long story like a novel. And okay. so I started, actually I went to see, now I can't think of her name, the author of Bird by Bird, Anne Lamott. I went to see mm-hmm. Anne Lamott speak at a bookstore nearby us many years ago. And one thing she said that really impressed me was to always carry paper and a pen around with you. And so I started carrying a little notebook in my pocket everywhere I went, and I scribbled down little things, like a few words at a time. And that was something that I could do, even if I was sitting at the playground with the kids or walking the dog or whatever. I could always keep a small amount in my head. And so that's part of what really intrigues me about poetry and picture books, just because that's what works for me. And also I really like the puzzle-solving kind of aspect, so that if I'm playing with words in a short poem or a short picture book, I really like arranging things, and to me it's like solving a puzzle, which is fun. I enjoy that.
Oh, that's really cool. And mm-hmm. and now I know you started with this first picture book. What made you kind of keep going with picture books? Because, I mean, I think in my experience, picture books are a really, really hard market to break into.
They are.
Yeah, it's a smaller market. So what has kept you kind of in that market and going? What has kept you inspired to stay there?
Well, part of it is what I just said about my love of language and the puzzle-solving aspect. But after my first book was published, Cats on Judy, I decided that I really, really wanted to learn more about writing for children. So I applied for the MFA program in writing for children and young adults at Vermont College of Fine Arts. And I was accepted, fortunately. I think that the bar is a lot higher now. The program was just getting started when I applied, and so I was really happy to be accepted. When I got into that program, and it's a low residency program, which means that you're only on campus for about 10 or 11 days each semester. It's a four-semester program, and these 10 or 11-day periods that you're on campus are called residencies. And so altogether, we did 5 residencies, one at the beginning of the program, one between each semester, and another at the end. And so when I got into that Vermont program, I made connections with a lot of other people. I had most just really amazing advisors to work with. And that really, I learned a lot more about picture books and poetry. It inspired even more interest for me. And so working with people in that kind of surrounding where everybody was talking about the same thing was just a really amazing experience. In fact, we had 15 people in our class, and we graduated in 2000. And we're still in touch every single day. We have our own little listserv, and if there's not a message from someone in my class on one day, it's disappointing. So we're really... everyone really supports each other, and it's been a huge source of comfort and inspiration for me. But that program really made a big difference for me.
So for those of us who, maybe don't have the money or the time to go to Vermont and study or the new program at Hamline, what kind of tips can you give to those of us who want to write picture books and want to kind of move into that direction? What are some concrete things we can do to improve our chances?
First of all, the most important thing for any writer to do is to read, and possibly even more important than writing or establishing a consistent writing schedule would be to just do as much reading as possible of the kind of books or poems that you want to write. And so go to the library, go to the bookstore. You don't have to spend a lot of money on picture books or magazines or whatever you want to be published in, but you can read a lot at a library and look for current things.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the books that are around now, especially if you're going to a library, a lot of the books that are older probably would not be published today. And so it's important to see what's being published now. And And then that gives you an idea also of where to submit things. Another really important thing is to join SCBWI, which is the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. And the website for that group is scbwi.org. There's a ton of information on the website itself, and anyone can access that, and then members can actually access a lot more information that's not available to the general public. So it's a really wonderful organization. It doesn't cost that much to join. Lots of contacts, lots of events here in Wisconsin. Our group has a fall conference every year where editors come and speak, and authors and illustrators, and then we have a spring luncheon, which was just last weekend, where usually one editor comes, and it's just a great group and a great way to get together and meet people who have the same goals.
That's great.
Oh, one more thing.
Yeah.
If you want to write for young children, try to understand the audience, and that might mean hanging out where young children hang out. Mm-hmm. And so I found that when my kids were little, I would often hear them say things that kind of sparked an idea. But I also, if I was at a playground or a park or someplace where a school even, where other kids were, I'd hear other kids say things too. And so if you keep your ears open and do a little eavesdropping, listen to what kids are saying. It gives you clues as to what they're thinking about and their point of view on different topics. So eavesdropping is a good technique, but reading is really important.
And you know, just a follow-up on that, I'm curious, you know, clearly you don't just, I mean, I think there's a sense that, oh, picture books, they're easy because they look so amazingly simple and great, you know, I think about, mm-hmm. and this is an old one, like Silly Sally Went to Town, Walking Backwards Upside Down. It's just such a simple, cute little book, and then you don't realize, like, how much effort went into that. So could you talk a little bit about how your poem moved from this little poem to a picture book?
Mm-hmm. Well,
what are some of the steps?
The process for me, there is no one source of inspiration. Each of my books really has a different different spark, but in general, whatever inspires the concept, whether it's a picture book or a poem. I mean, I've had a title jump into my head that I had to write a book around. I've had a memory of something that happened either when my sisters and I were kids or that our kids have talked about. Sometimes it's a combination of two of those little scraps of paper sitting on my desk of little notes that I've taken someplace. Sometimes when I'm in that little pocket notebook that I carry around, I might write down one word. And somehow just that one word on a piece of notepaper might combine with something else that I've been thinking about, because things do tend to pop up over and over if there's a topic that I'm interested in. From that point, I will just start brainstorming. And I will come up with, usually I start out with something that looks like a list of possible lines or ideas or topics. And I just keep narrowing that list and refining it. And I go through draft after draft after draft on paper first. I usually just write, I always start out longhand. I usually write in a spiral notebook or on a legal pad, and I almost always, if I can, use a purple pen. I don't know why. It just appeals to me. After I've written as many drafts as it takes on paper, and sometimes it's many, sometimes it's 10, sometimes it's 25, sometimes it's more. Then I finally, if I'm satisfied that I've gone as far as I can on paper, then I type it on the computer. And I'll print that draft, and I will scribble all over it as long as it takes, and keep revising it on the computer till I feel like I've done everything I can. And at that point, I know I'm probably not done. I usually have some specific questions about what's working and what's not, and I will send it to my writing group. I actually have two writing groups. One of them has been meeting regularly for about 14 or 15 years now. And the other one is newer, and we don't meet as regularly, but we have sort of a different approach. We actually get together in a retreat once a year. And so that's a really nice, it's really nice to have that weekend where we focus on writing. But both of those writing groups give me feedback on my work and vice versa. And often, someone will come up with something that just never occurred to me. Usually, if I submit something that I have a specific question about, they'll have an answer. And if I submit something that has, if there's something that's bugging me but I don't mention it, someone will always find it. They're good readers, and they're really perceptive, and they're very, very helpful at the same time that they're also very supportive.
Oh, that's great. Go ahead.
When they say that something is ready to submit, that's when I know it's ready. And so at that point, I'll submit to an editor, and then there's a long, long waiting time. And usually I will try to work on something else while I wait to hear back from the editor. It could be months. It has often been more than a year before I hear back from an editor on a manuscript that I've submitted. And once a manuscript is accepted, then often it needs to be revised some more. So it's a very long process.
Wow, it's amazing because it just looks so easy when you pick up that book.
Oh yeah.
Well, I want to transition a little bit to your newest book, which is a nonfiction book on writing called Write a Poem Step by Step. And can you talk a little bit about how it evolved and what it is?
Sure. Write a Poem Step, it's subtitled A Simple Logical Plan You Can Follow to Create Your Own Poems. And this book evolved, it started when I was a student in Vermont College. One of the requirements for the program was to give a graduating lecture, and we also had to write a thesis. And I knew when I went to Vermont that I wanted to work on poetry while I was there. And while I was there, I worked with several advisors on poetry, and I ended up giving my graduating lecture on something very similar to this topic. My thesis was called What Makes a Poem a Poem? And both of those topics, What Makes a Poem a Poem and Write a Poem Step by Step, have evolved into presentations that I do in schools. And I started out as a volunteer. I went to our kids' school. In both of their grades, from the time that our older son was in first grade until they were both through elementary school. So from first to sixth grade, I went to both of their classes almost every year and just worked with students in writing poems. And so the plan really evolved from those initial volunteer visits into something that I felt confident enough to present to the school and ask to be paid for. And over the years, now this has been, again, probably at least maybe 12 or 13 years I've been doing this in the schools, and when I find a poem that I really like that one of the students has written, I write to their parents and ask for permission to use it in my presentations, and 25 of those poems have ended up in this book. The plan itself, I came up with when I was working on my thesis. I decided to analyze a poem sort of from the outside looking in five steps, beginning with the form of the poem and then going back to the patterns, the rhythm, rhyme, and repetition, looking at the language and then the imagery and then actually finally the idea. And so when I started thinking about writing a poem step by step, I used those same five steps in the reverse order. And so the first step is to come up with an idea, a good idea, and then look at imagery and language and patterns and form. So it's sort of in the reverse order that I would use to analyze a poem that someone else has already written. And so that's how Write a Poem Step by Step, that's how the process evolved. While I was still in Vermont College, I submitted in one of my son's classes, in my older son's third grade class, I worked with a group, with the whole class for, I visited the class 9 times, and each student wrote a really wonderful poem over that extended period of time. And I submitted those to Barbara Duster Esmondson as a poet whose husband, after she died, established an award in her name for anyone who used her book, which is called A Celebration of Bees, and it has her advice about helping students to write poetry. And so he established this award in her name for anyone who used her book to work with students. And I sent the student poems in and won that award in 2000 for
one
of the grade class. It was a really wonderful experience, and the kids were so excited about it. I decided to self-publish the book because I submitted it to many traditional publishers, and I kept hearing back that, first of all, that it should be a paperback book, and some publishers only do hardcovers. Another thing is that it had this educational component, and a lot of the publishers were just not going in that direction, that it was something that was aimed more towards schools and libraries. And so after I heard that feedback, and the feedback about the content was all good, but about the publishing companies themselves was just that they weren't suited. And so I decided to self-publish it. It was something that I was interested in doing anyway, and I thought this would be a good project to try self-publishing with. And it was a really good experience. I'm glad I did it. I still, when I do school visits now, I still keep collecting poems because I think that what I will do is eventually I'd like to add some in training materials for teachers and keep using them in the presentations themselves so that someone who has a copy of the book and also goes to a presentation doesn't see the same poems in both places. So I'm still collecting poems now to keep using. It's wonderful, though, to see what the kids write.
And can you talk about maybe like a couple of tools from the book, or even just one that you use in your writing, like something that you put in the book that you found has been really helpful for you and really helpful for your students?
Okay, well, let's see. I think the thing that I have the most, that I myself have the most trouble with sometimes is just getting the rhythm right.
Mm.
And so I have a section on scanning a poem and rhythm and meter. And I actually use scansion on my own work sparingly when I'm stuck. And so I think that's probably a useful skill to have, to be able to scan a poem and make sure that the rhythm is really working well. Probably included in the book, there's a lot of brainstorming steps about finding a good idea, brainstorming steps for using imagery, specific language techniques. Possibly the one thing that most people get stuck on in poetry is setting up the form. And there's a technique that I use in the book for reading a poem aloud and then just marking on the page where your voice stops when you're reading, and considering that as the first option for ending a line so that that line break gives a poem its form on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that most people who are interested in writing poetry probably know enough about language and imagery and ideas and patterns and possibly rhythm and rhyme and all of those things. But the hardest part for someone who's not really familiar with writing poetry is just to decide where to put in a line break so that the poem has a form on the page. And typically, a line break, the most logical place for a line break is just at the end of a complete thought. I often find that students who write poems, who write a first draft of a poem, will write all the way across from one margin to the other instead of breaking lines so that the poem looks like a poem on the page. And so that's a very simple technique that gives you at least something to start with if you just put a thought on each line, and then you can play around with it after that.
Oh, that's great.
and how it sounds too.
And I think what I really like about the book, and I've been teaching writing in the poetry writing in the school since my son was a first grader too, and I think what's so helpful to me about the book is it makes something that feels so ephemeral very concrete. You know, because when you say poetry to a bunch of kids, they look at you like, oh, gross, love, roses, and then complicated.
Uh-huh.
There's all these
yeah.
forms, there's all these rules.
Yeah.
It's scary. And I think your book makes it really easy to kind of just, you know, do the steps and come out with something.
Well, and a lot of kids think that a poem has to rhyme.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that I try to tell them right off the bat. It doesn't have to rhyme. There's a lot of other forms that don't rhyme. And it's so much easier to say what you want to say than to keep chasing after the rat hat, mat, flat, bat,
yes.
sort of rhyming words that become so repetitive that it becomes predictable, and then that means boring. And
yeah.
kids understand that. When you explain that to them, they get it right off the bat. They know what you're talking about. And
yep.
so I think that it is actually sort of freeing to know that a poem doesn't have to rhyme. And usually there's a big sigh of relief when I say, no, you don't have to rhyme if you don't want to. But if you do want to, there are tips in the book also for what to avoid if you're interested
okay.
in writing in rhyme, so that your poem doesn't end up sounding forced.
That's great. Well, I want to switch gears a little bit, because the one thing I never knew until I read this most recent bio is that you've written more than 125 nonfiction books.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about that nonfiction work, and what do you do? What have you written, and what's that like? What's
well,
the process?
After I graduated from Vermont College, someone introduced me to an editor at a company sort of right in my neighborhood, Gareth Stevens Publishing. Unfortunately, they've moved since then. But I did end up doing some freelance work for them. And I started out as a proofreader, and then an editor, and then a writer. And so all on a freelance basis. And they publish educational books for children. The difference between educational publishers and trade publishers. Now, trade books are the books that you find in bookstores. And they might also end up in libraries and schools, but they're typically found and promoted especially towards bookstores. Educational books, which might also be called informational books or school and library books, are intended for schools and libraries, and a lot of them are used specifically for research. They have another purpose than just entertainment. And so for the beginning reader books that I wrote, the purpose was really to teach kids to read, even more than to give them the information that was contained in the book. And so what's important about writing those books is the format and the language and the kinds of things that you can do to help a young student learn how to read, like giving definitions in the context of a story or a page or whatever the information is, so that if someone doesn't understand a word, they can find it right there in the context. Those kinds of things are important in writing those beginning readers. After I did some freelance work, I actually worked at Gareth Stevens as a managing editor for 2 years, and then I got involved in the whole process of assigning books to writers and helping to decide what topics we would publish and what kinds of series would fit into a program each. We had two publishing seasons a year. And most of the books that Gareth Stevens published, and this is similar to other educational publishers, we would publish books in a series, something like some of the ones that I wrote, for example, one of the first series that I wrote for Gareth Stevens was called Animals I See at the Zoo, and there were 12 of them. And each one was about a different animal and its life cycle, what it eats, what it how it lives, where it lives, all those kinds of things. And then I had a series called animals that live in the desert, animals that live in the forest, animals that live in the mountain. There are six of each of those. So by writing six at a time, your total book count adds up pretty quickly. And so I wrote, I think, 86 books in a period of something like 6 years. Typically,
wow.
Those books are not only very short, but there's a very short deadline. There's a very short time to read them. So they might assign you six books on similar topics in one series and give you something like 3 months to write them, which happens pretty regularly. The ones that I wrote, after I did a few of them, I sort of got into a rhythm so that I knew what to expect and how to do the research and what I would need to include. Typically, those nonfiction books for educational publishers also include a lot of end matter, like maps and usually there's an index, a table of contents, and a glossary at the end. And so all of those things would also have to be included. Sometimes I would also have to provide photographs, not the photographs themselves, but a description of what kinds of photographs, and then there would be a photography researcher who would actually find the one. So I might have to say, in this case, we're looking for a picture of a lion stalking an animal in the jungle, or so, you know, something like that. So you'd be specific about what kinds of details to include. But those books also had really strict format requirements, and so the reading level had to be a specific. There were within a specific range, and lots of restrictions about word count and those kinds of things. And so it was a challenge. Again, back to that puzzle-solving kind of appeal.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed that. But I also found that I really liked doing the research, and so that led to my one nonfiction book. I've written other nonfiction picture books, but the one that was published, Flip, Flip, Fly, Seeds on the Move, actually grew out of this experience of writing nonfiction books for educational publishers, because the other thing is that the topics are assigned.
Mm.
And so the publishers themselves will decide, well, this season we're going to publish these series, and then they go out and find the writers to do them, to write them. And so if you're interested in writing for educational publishers, you can submit your writing sample and your contact information to one of those educational publishers, and they might contact you and ask you to write a book. I have a link on my website, joannemackin.com, www.joannemackin.com, to a list of educational markets, and this is on a website by Evelyn Christensen. There is a link on my website, though. And so it's a place where if you're interested in writing those educational books, you can send, it's a list of companies who publish them, so you can send them your contact information and a writing sample, and they might contact you and ask you to do more.
Oh, that's great. And typically, I'm guessing that these are work for hire, so you get paid once,
yes,
and then it's kind of, that's it, right?
Yes, that's another important distinction. Usually there's a flat fee. Now, when I first started writing these, some of my first earliest books, I was paid $250 for, and that was
wow.
It. I also do not own the copyright.
Okay.
Now, some publishers have gone up considerably since then. They might be $300 now, or they might be $500, or they might be more, again, depending on the length. I did write one longer nonfiction work-for-hire book. It was a biography of Gary Paulson for Ensler Publishers. And that's the only nonfiction book for an educational publisher that I've ever written that has a contract that specifies a royalty agreement. But typically there is the work-for-hire books pay a flat fee, you don't own the copyright, and they can take it and do whatever they want with it when you're done. An advantage, though, is that you learn a lot by writing these books. You learn a lot about the research process. You learn about working with editors. And you just learn what you're capable of and what you enjoy.
Wow.
So all of that is important.
So, and tell me a little bit about kind of your passions besides writing and how they influence your work? I mean, I'm guessing there's something about seeds and gardening and growing because you wrote Seeds on the Move. And something about weather because of your wonderful weather prompt and your story, Waiting Out the Storm. So talk a little bit about your passions and how they influence your writing.
Sure. Well, you already know about gardening. We live in a really a small house on a really small yard, and we would love to have a larger yard so we could do some gardening. But what we have a really steep hill in the front of our house. And my husband, when we first moved here, was having problems with his ankles from pushing the lawnmower up the steep hill. We decided that we would turn it into a rock garden. And so we have, our whole front hill is all perennials. And I learned a lot about local plants and how things grow around here. And we're in Wisconsin. And so gardening has always been fun. My husband is more into the vegetables, and I'm more into the flowers, but we sort of both do both. He helps me, and I help him. He has planted, actually, vegetables in three of our neighbors' yards. He has garden plots because we don't have enough room in our own. And so we have one neighbor who has some health issues and isn't able to plant, so he put a big garden in her backyard, and she goes out there and picks the vegetables, and so we kind of share them, but he does the work. And so gardening has always been an issue and something that I care a lot about. Back from the time that we were little, my mother always had hollyhocks in the yard, and she taught us how to make little sort of dolls out of them. When we were kids, we would take a bud and put it on an upside-down flower, and that was something we played with. I remember my grandmother having a yard full of lilies of the valley, and so that's always been one of my favorite flowers. It's been a lot of, it means a lot to me. It has a lot of memories. Besides gardening, I'm really interested in photography, and that goes along with everything else we do. So I take pictures of the flowers that I see, and I'm also interested in birds. I really like to follow birds. I've written a lot of things about birds that haven't been published. Poems mostly. We go camping a lot. Well, not a lot. Not as much as I'd like to. And we often, when we go camping, we take canoes and we'll just paddle down a river, like especially the Wisconsin River is one of our favorites because it's wide and flat and slow, and it's typically not very dangerous, which makes me nervous. And we can camp along on sidebars anywhere or islands anywhere in the river. And so it's rather than going to a campground where it might be crowded or noisy, we just kind of float down the river and stay wherever we find a spot, which is really fun. So while we're doing this camping or canoeing or gardening or whatever, I'm also enjoying taking pictures of them. And I use those photographs a lot in my school visits. I have a presentation about things that inspire me, and a lot of those animal pictures that I've taken actually have, the things that I've learned about them have gone into books like Waiting Out the Storm. Waiting Out the Storm is a picture book that's about a girl and her mother who are outside in the yard, and the Susan Gabert made these gorgeous illustrations of the two people picking flowers, and the scenery is just beautiful. And so when thinking about things like the animals that I've seen and the pictures that I've taken, those kinds of inspirations have gone into Waiting Out the Storm. And so in the story of Waiting Out the Storm, this little girl and her mother are outside in the yard when a storm comes up, and they talk about what the different animals do in the storm. What do the ducks do, and what do the turtles do, and what do the chipmunks do? And so some of that, even though it's nonfiction, it did make its way into a fiction story. Waiting Out the Storm actually came about originally after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And along with a lot of other writers, I think, I felt after that I couldn't write. I was just sort of frozen. I couldn't think of anything that didn't seem frivolous or foolish or silly to even try to write about. But what I decided I wanted to do was I wanted to say something reassuring to kids who were frightened. And so I couldn't write about something as huge or frightening as terrorism, but I thought of a storm as kind of a symbol of things that, one of the things that scare people, scare young people especially. And so waiting out the storm developed out of that, and out of that desire to say something to something helpful to kids who were scared. And that's
wow.
How the book came about.
Very cool. Well, I want to open it up to listeners and see if there are any questions. So if you want to ask a question, you can unmute yourself by pushing *7. I may just unmute you all in case anybody wants to ask a question. And if you feel like it's going to be loud where you are and you want to mute yourself right away, go ahead and push *6. If you have a question, go ahead and ask it at this time. Anybody have a question for Joanne?
I'm Beth in Waukesha, and my ears pricked up when you, Joanne, said that you proofread.
No, it's on mute. Okay.
I like books to be correct, and I've been told by two different publishers that they want that kind of work done in-house. Well, I wish it had been done in-house, too, but I see published results that show that they needed my kind of skill and didn't get it. And I would like to help, but apparently I need some different kind of approach in order to be able to help.
So are you saying that you're looking for work proofreading, like freelance work?
I would very much like to do freelance proofreading, yes.
Yeah. If you go to my website, www.joannemackin.com, look for that list of educational publishers. That would be one place that you might start. On the page that says, let's see, what page is it? It says My Books on the top.
Okay.
And if you scroll down on the right-hand side, there is a heading that says Educational Publishing, and there is a link there to Evelyn Christensen's list of educational markets. And you might begin by writing to some of those companies and offering your services as a freelance proofreader. It's worth a try.
Bless your heart. Is this the Evelyn Christensen that wrote What Happens When Women Pray, or is this a different person with the same name?
I don't know.
Thank you very much.
Follow that link, and good luck.
And for those of you who are wondering about the link, Joanne, what I'll do is when I send out the links to the recording, I will send out a link to that page on your website as well as your website and SCBWI so people can easily connect with that. Thank you, Beth. Any other questions?
I just want to say a huge thank you because this has been fascinating and encouraging information.
Great. Glad to hear it.
Thank you.
We tend to have a very quiet group, Joanne, so I'm going to ask a few more times if there are any questions. Sometimes people eat lunch while they're listening and, you know, don't want to be talking over the cubicle. So does anybody have any other questions?
You know, I have a couple other things I could talk about.
Sure, I'd love to hear it. I have more questions, too. Go ahead.
And then someone else might come up with another question based on this.
Okay.
One of the questions that I don't think I finished answering was about the inspiration for some of my other books. And I know I mentioned it for Waiting Out the Storm, and I think I talked about it for Flip, Flip, Fly, Seeds on the Move. But a couple of my other books were also inspired. I find that what goes into my books is often something right out of my life. And I've seen this in other people's books, too. For example, when I wrote the biography of the author Gary Paulsen, I read a lot of his own autobiographical materials. And I noticed that he used really specific events from his own life in the stories that he wrote for kids. For example, he said that at one point in his life he bought a sailboat. And in order to learn how to sail, he just got in it and took off. And he found himself 200 miles away before he figured out how to turn around and get back. Well, lo and behold, in one of his fiction books, for young readers, he has a story of a boy who inherits a sailboat from his uncle and decides to get in it and finds himself 200 miles away from home. And so I think specific details like that end up in our books because they are what we know. And so, for example, in Sing-Along Song, when I wrote Sing-Along Song, it was, Sing-Along Song is the story of a boy who sings all day long, and he sings along with everything he runs into during the day. He sings along with a robin and a bee and a squirrel and everybody in his family, a dog and a cat and each of his parents and his little sister. And many, many of the details in that book came from my own life, especially the main idea of the boy who sings, because we have a son who sings all day long still. He's in college now, and he's still safe. He's home. We know he's home because we can hear him singing. And so that was a big inspiration, but it was also, there is a page in there where I talk about the father coming home, and when I wrote this book, my father had just died, and it was a very, very difficult spring. I was just having a really hard time. It was way back when I was still at Vermont College. And, you know, I think that it comes through in the book. One of my classmates from Vermont College wrote to me, and she said, I inexplicably burst into tears when I read the page of the father coming home. And I said, well, it's probably because I put so many tears into that page.
Wow.
It was just something that really struck me. But everything from word choice, there is a part where the mother says, or the song that for the mother coming in to, with dinner says, what a feast, it smells delish. Well, one of my sisters used to say that all the time when she was feeding our kids when they were little. She would always say, ooh, delish. So that came right out of her language. And there was also a song that inspired me called How Can I Keep From Singing?
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that I heard in church. I think it's a Quaker hymn that I heard.
Mm-hmm.
And it just really struck me. And so all of those bits and pieces came together in this book. And I think that they all came from my life, but in very different ways and different angles. And then Baby Says Moo is my newest picture book. And I grew up with, I have six sisters. And when we were little, We sort of divided ourselves into the big kids and the little kids, and I am the second oldest, and so I was one of the big kids, and the big kids always played this game with the little kids, with whoever was the baby at the time, about what does the dog say, what does the cat say, what does the bird say, and asking those questions that I know people still do with little babies. And one day, and then of course my husband and I did that with our kids when they were little too. One day I was just walking the dog, and I thought about that game, and I thought, what if the baby gave the wrong answer?
Mm-hmm.
And then I just thought, what if the baby gave the same wrong answer every time? And so Baby Says Moo is about a baby who answers moo to every question. What does the dog say? What does the cat say? What does the bird say? And finally, at the end, the parents find the baby a cow, so the baby gets to say moo and be correct. I had a lot of fun writing that book. That was, I think it's the of my books that has the most humor in it. And kids also like joining in on the moo part when they read aloud. So that's
no kidding. How fun.
To read aloud.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. So, you know, as we're kind of like moving into our day from our conversation with you, what tips can you share for us, for those of us who are writers? How can we kind of take some of the things you've talk to us about and use them in our own writing?
Well, again, I'll say the most important thing for a writer to do is to read.
Mm.
And I think the second most important thing is to, the second most important thing is probably just to keep trying and not give up.
Mm.
And the way to do that, I think, is often to have support from other people, a writing group, classes, social media in a reasonable amount. But also I think that it's not necessary to take the advice that says you have to write every day or you have to do this or you have to do that. It's more important to work out what works best for you.
Mm.
I would love to write every day, but I can't and I don't. And so I've learned or I'm trying at least to stop feeling guilty about not writing every single day, because sometimes you just can't do that. And so you have to sort of give yourself permission to do what you can and just keep going.
Okay.
At whatever pace you have, and just keep trying and don't give up.
And you know, as you talk about that advice, that's really helpful to kind of don't do what everybody says to do, but do what works for you. Tell me a little bit about what your week is like. Do you write a few days a week? Do you have a couple of set times when you write, or do you kind of try to fit it in with school visits and family stuff?
It varies a lot. And I love doing school visits, but when I do them, they really take up the whole day. So on those days, I might be jotting a few things down in a notebook before or after, in between things. On the days that I'm home, my schedule varies a lot because I teach, and I have to make that a high priority, maybe not the very top priority, but it's important for me to work around my teaching schedule. And then, of course, well, family things always come up. Everybody knows how that is. Sometimes family things are the most important things that we have, and we just have to work around them. And so we do what we can. On the days that I'm home and not doing a school visit or not teaching, I like to start writing first thing in the morning because that's when my brain is the freshest, and I don't seem to have the critical voice in the back of my head saying, oh, you know, who do you think you're kidding? I'm not as critical of my own work.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it's important for me to start first thing in the morning. If I wait till later in the day, somehow I have that voice sort of on my shoulder or whispering in my ear saying, oh, you know, you're not very good at this. Why don't you give up now? And so the way for me to avoid that is to start in the morning. Might be different for other people. Other people might do better late at night or in the middle of the day or little bits and pieces or in big, long stretches, whatever works.
Oh, that's great. Well, this has been so helpful, Joanne. I really appreciate it. I'm going to ask you for one final piece of wisdom, but first I want to remind our listeners, I'll be sending out the recording this Friday along with the links to Joanne's website, joannemackin.com. If you have a chance today, go to my blog, rightnowcoach.com/blog, find Joanne's post and comment or do whatever you need to do to enter to win a copy of her book. The contest ends at midnight. If you're a Right Now Coach regular, you know that we have two very exciting events coming up. On May 22nd, Diana Gebhardt's going to be talking about writing for the middle grade audience, so kind of upper elementary, early middle school kids, what are they reading, what are they interested in, how do you break into that market. And on June 19th, we're going to have a publishing panel, and we're going to be talking about kind of what goes into a book if you self-publish it, and how do you do that, and what's all the steps, because although it looks easier, there's still steps that you need to take to make sure you have a good product. So I look forward to seeing you then. Joanne, do you have a final tip for our listeners?
I do. I have one final piece of wisdom, and that is don't save anything. And what I mean by that is if you have one more idea and you're thinking, well, maybe I'll put this in something else, maybe there's a sequel, maybe I'll do it, don't. Put it all in. Don't save anything for later because you will get more ideas. Don't ever think that you're done with good ideas. Put it all in. That's my last tip.
That's amazing. I don't think I've ever heard that before. That's a great tip.
I learned the hard way.
That's wonderful. Joanne, thanks so much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Welcome.
Everyone, this is Rochelle. Oh, I'm so glad that you were here. Everyone, this is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach, and this has been the Right Now Mastermind class for April 2013. Remember to always write. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.